Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a looming showdown between White House Chief of Staff Kelly and the President's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who is resisting giving up his access to the nation's top secrets, which, although he does not have a permanent security clearance, Kushner is the biggest consumer of in terms of top secret information, much of which could be highly profitable to private business interests. Jeff Stein, who covers spy agencies and foreign policy for Newsweek and wrote the Spy Talk column for the Congressional Quarterly, joins us to discuss how vulnerable the Trump White House is to foreign spies, with 130 staffers with access to top secrets unable to get security clearances. We will also speculate on why the intelligence community does not want to give Kushner a security clearance and why he is getting his hands on so much vital intelligence as possible, even though he has not qualified for a permanent security clearance. Then we'll investigate what could be the most amazing power play and greatest coup by the Koch brothers, who are poised to rewrite the entire U.S. Constitution according to their policy preferences and ideological whims and wishes. Joining us is Lisa Graves, the co-director of Documented, a new investigative website at documentedinvestigations.org, who served in all three branches of the federal government as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. We will discuss how the entire U.S. Constitution could be up for grabs if the Koch-funded effort to bring about a constitutional convention via the ratification of 34 states is successful. Then finally, we'll continue to explore the possibility that the laws of the land and the very foundation of American democracy are about to be rewritten by the Koch brothers, who already have 28 of the 34 states needed to convene a constitutional convention in their pocket. So it would seem that the billionaire right-wing donors are well on their way to pulling off the ultimate coup. Alex Koch, an investigative journalist focusing on money in politics, who was until recently part of the Political Capital Investigative Unit at the International Business Times, joins us to discuss his article at the Center for Media and Democracy, Koch's Bankroll Move to Rewrite the Constitution. And joining us now is Jeff Stein, who covers the spy agencies and foreign policy for Newsweek in Washington. His Spy Talk column originated in 2005 at the Congressional Quarterly, where he was Homeland Security Editor, and he moved to the Washington Post in 2010. An Army Intelligence Case Officer in Vietnam, Jeff is also the author of three books, including A Murder in Wartime, about the 1969 prosecution of top Green Beret officers for the execution of a suspected enemy spy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Stein.
Thank you.
And what do you make of the resistance that Jared Kushner is displaying? Apparently, the White House Chief of Staff, General Kelly, is trying to rein in the apparently loose operations at the White House in terms of handling of the most top-secret documents. In fact, the nation's top secrets. Obviously, they passed through the hands of Rob Portman, and that concerned a lot of people because he had a temporary pass and could possibly have been blackmailed as a wife beater. But Jared Kushner apparently is the biggest consumer of top secret intelligence, and he doesn't want to give up, or he's resisting the idea that because he can't get a permanent clearance, he's going to lose his clearance. So do we have any idea of what's behind that? Why the intelligence community does not want to give him a clearance?
Well, at first glance, it would seem like this is a battle between Godzilla and King Kong, but they were nicer and more transparent than the key actors in the White House. First of all, the president could solve this problem in a heartbeat, either by granting Jared Kushner a clearance by executive fiat, which would raise a lot of objections. There'd be a lot of howling about that. Or the president could say, sorry, you're not going to get a clearance. That's the choice for the president. It's not going to be up to Mr. Kelly, who has shown an increasing tendency to bend to the president's needs over conducting the office of the chief of staff with neutrality and probity, with his main client being the people of the United States. So we're going to have this situation continue until The president makes a decision. That's who's going to make the decision.
But the fact that something like 130 of these top White House employees don't have a permanent intelligence clearance, and I think that's a pretty high ratio. I think there's only about 600 employees, is there not, in the executive branch? I'm not sure the numbers, but it's an awfully high ratio of people, 130. And is it completely off the wall to suggest, for example, that given what we've learned from the recent Mueller indictment about how much the Russians have penetrated social media and how active their information manipulation campaign was during the elections, isn't it conceivable that they could be also targeting the White House for intelligence leaks?
Well, of course. I mean, the Russians have been targeting the White House for leaks and recruitments going back to the Soviet Union. This is, and we target the Russians for recruitment and penetration. This is what intelligence agencies do. So, of course, the Russians or anyone else with a major intelligence service like the Chinese would be looking for targets of opportunity. And you know, remember that the Office of Personnel Management files of federal employees, tens of thousands, were hacked a couple of years ago. So that, you know, our adversaries have access to lots of personal information about federal employees. And you add to that an administration which is riven with conflicts of interest. So putting aside what sexual misconduct may have occurred or allegations of domestic abuse and so on. So you've got really, from a security standpoint, kind of a nightmare here. And let's not forget that the president of the United States has virtually refused to accept the idea of Russian penetration and that the Russians helped put him into office, and that he has not ordered up a comprehensive plan for defending the nation against Russian intrusion or to combat, to take more aggressive measures against the Russians that would cause them to stop doing what they're doing in the cyberspace. So this is just another chapter in what I call the new abnormal. Lots of unprecedented things going on in this administration. And by law or by statute and rule, these clearances, these interim clearances, are supposed to run out in a year. That puts a lot of these people in jeopardy, and it places a quandary in front of the chief of staff, Mr. Kelly. If he begins to act on the revocation of these interim clearances, that's going to put him smack up against the president's son-in-law and daughter. It's been widely reported that Mr. Kushner has been opaque about his business dealings and his efforts to sell his property at 666 Fifth Avenue. He's approached Chinese and other foreign investors to take that off his hands. Ivanka Trump is robustly continuing her private business around the world. The Chinese have afforded her some favors, as have the Indians. We've got Donald Jr. hyping his business, Trump business in India, while giving policy speeches. In an ordinary administration, this kind of behavior just would be prohibited. But we're not dealing with an ordinary administration. So there's not only a security overlay problem here, but an internal political struggle between the Trump family and security professionals such as General Kelly and others, General McMaster and others, who are alarmed about the access that uncleared individuals are getting to top secret intelligence.
And again, I'm speaking with Jeff Stein, who covers the spy agencies and foreign policy at For Newsweek in Washington, D.C. His Spy Talk column originated in 2005 at the Congressional Quarterly, where he was Homeland Security Editor, and he moved to the Washington Post in 2010. And he served as an Army Intelligence Case Officer in Vietnam and is the author of three books, including A Murder in Wartime, about the 1969 prosecution of top Green Beret officers for the execution of a suspected enemy spy. So just to zero in, though, on Kushner himself, given all the portfolios he had, the fact that he apparently is the biggest consumer of top-secret intelligence and reads the presidential daily brief, which apparently Donald Trump is not interested in reading or not able, you know, apparently he likes things down to about a page or to see them on television as opposed to have to read them. So that's very strange. On the one hand, you can't get a permanent clearance, and there has to be a reason for that. And on the other hand, he has access to the top secret stuff, the most secret stuff, and apparently he's resisting giving up that access. So we don't know why the intelligence community won't give him a clearance, but what we've learned so far is the White House Office of Security has said that his paperwork has been about the worst and most deficient that they've seen in the longest time. He apparently was interviewed by the head of the FBI, head of counterintelligence, who warned him about his and Ivanka's relationship with Wendy Deng, the ex-wife of Rupert Murdoch, who Murdoch accuses of being a Chinese spy. And, of course, she had an affair with Tony Blair that broke up her marriage with Murdoch. So he's obviously a little bitter about that. But that's been raised. Do you have any inkling? I mean, the fact that Kushner has such a close relationship with the Israelis, is that a flag? I know some time back when we last spoke, you had done an article about Israel's spying on the U.S., which my understanding is that Israeli spying on the U.S. is one of the most aggressive of foreign countries. And of course, Israel is something of an ally. So I'm throwing out some possibilities here. Has anything crossed your radar that would explain why the intelligence community doesn't want to give Jared Kushner a complete intelligence clearance?
Well, he's a walking security nightmare. I mean, in an ordinary administration, this guy just would not get a job. I mean, he would not be cleared. He would not be in a position, certainly, where he's reading the president's daily brief, which the president doesn't read, but Kushner, by all accounts, is avidly reading the president's daily intelligence brief from the CIA and the National Intelligence Director. And he's also reportedly making lots of inquiries from after he reads this brief to intelligence officials. So, you know, this is just highly unusual, to say the least. I suspect, from my conversations in the intelligence community, that the intelligence professionals at CIA in particular are lobbying Mike Pompeo, the CIA director, vociferously to keep that brief as narrow as possible and certainly not deliver the family jewels to the president and thus to Jared Kushner about CIA assets in high places in the world. And perhaps even significant internal political developments in China and Russia and India, Pakistan and so on, because the Kushners and the Trumps have such interlocking business interests around the world that this could be very valuable information for them to act on in service of their businesses. So the battle is going to come to a climax soon, because this is a boil about to burst. The situation cannot continue. Jared Kushner has made it very clear that he and Ivanka, his wife, think that Kelly is using this security clearance issue to box them out of the White House. And I would bet a lot of money that if Kelly takes on Kushner and Ivanka, he's going to lose. And then Trump faces a dilemma that Kelly would leave the White House with lots of secrets and knowledge about how the president runs the White House. And then there would be the difficulty of getting anyone else to replace Kelly. So here we just have another turn of the wheel, another chapter of chaos inside the White House, where lots of questions, at the same time, lots of questions are being raised about the basic loyalty of the president to the United States toward Russia, which may hold lots of investments in Trump. The suspicion is that, as Don Jr. Himself said a few years ago, that the Russians floated the Trump empire when he couldn't get loans elsewhere because of his bankruptcies and the collapse of his Atlantic City business. And so we... This is stuff out of a spy novel. You know, this is Manchurian Candidate territory. It's unprecedented, and we don't know how this is going to turn out, but someone's going to win and someone's going to lose in this struggle in the White House over the security clearances. They both can't win. Jared Kushner and Kelly cannot both emerge as winners here.
And we have, of course, the Steve Bannon taking on Kushner and losing. But back to the issue that you brought up about a possible conflict of interest in terms of business, my understanding is that, and I recall this when Ronald Reagan chose Bill Casey as his director of Central Intelligence, Casey things were held up for a while in terms of his confirmation because he wouldn't put all of his holdings into a blind trust or resisted it. And he was a Wall Street banker and lawyer. And at the time, I recall, the questions were that it's not kosher for a director of Central Intelligence who may want to play the market, having access to the best secrets in the world from which he could get incredibly rich. That is a reality, isn't it, Jeff?
Sure. Absolutely. That's the obvious reality, that you have... Well, it's not just Kushner, it's Trump as well. Trump has not divested himself. He's stepped back from the act. He says he stepped back from the active management of his companies, but anyone who's observed him closely over the past couple of years would say that that's laughable that he would step away from the management of his companies. He may leave the day-to-day or minute-by-minute decisions to his sons, daughter, but, you know, this is a guy who demonstrably does not understand the limits of his behavior while being a federal officer, to wit, the president of the United States. He has shown again and again that he doesn't understand conflicts of interest. He's talked openly about his FBI, his Justice Department, and complain that his officials are not doing what he wants them to do in terms of the Russian investigation. So we shouldn't be surprised that there is a commingling of insider intelligence information and the Trump and Kushner business interests, and Ivanka business interests for that matter.
Just in closing, though, Jeff, what do you make of this extraordinary meeting that took place recently with Pompeo and Dan Coats and the heads of Russia's three intelligence agencies, the GRU, military intelligence, SVR, foreign intelligence, and FSB, domestic intelligence? All three of those heads of those agencies in Russia are sanctioned, yet they were able to come to Washington, have this private meeting, and things have changed. There's something going on. For example, the character that is called Putin's cook, Prigozhin, he also was organized this mercenary army that just got slaughtered by the U.S. in Syria, and it's hard to believe that the Russians didn't hang them out to dry since they gave them no air cover and sent them on a suicide mission. Is it possible that something's going on there? A deal is being struck between Putin and Trump. Prigozhin is being essentially sacrificed by Putin because of the Mueller indictment, in the sense that Putin will say, as he's always said, oh, you know, this wasn't an official Russian operation meddling with the American election. You know, a few patriotic Russians did this on their own. So do you think that they may be scapegoating Prigozhin to put this whole thing behind them? Is that a possibility?
That's a pretty convoluted question. I don't know what's going on inside the Kremlin. But I will say that Pompeo's explanation for meeting with Russian intelligence, that it was innocent and kind of normal business between the CIA and the FSB on counterterrorism issues, smacks to me of the same excuse that was given for the meeting that Kushner et al. Had with Russian emissaries during the campaign, and they said they just discussed adoptions. You've just got to suspect that there was more on the table in that meeting between Pompeo and the FSB chief that had to do with wider U.S.-Russian relations, which there would be nothing wrong with that, except that the FSB is a major player in the continuing assaults, interference in American politics by the Russians. We should probably not be meeting with the Russians at all, and certainly not at the high level of the chiefs. The legal attaché, the U.S. legal attaché, the FBI agent in Moscow, is perfectly capable of meeting with his counterpart, his Russian counterpart, to discuss counterterrorism issues. So you just have to, you know, red flags go up when you see Mike Pompeo, who is a confidant of the president by all accounts, and shares his political or ideological, I don't know if I can dress it up that much, but his political leanings. He was a Tea Party Republican while he was in Congress, and very much part of the assault on Hillary Clinton over the Benghazi issue and so on. So you have to think that there's more in play here than mere counterterrorism discussions. It's just, and it looked bad. I mean, it just, you know, you just have to wonder what's going on with this administration. Are they Russian dupes? Are they Russian assets? This is a horrible situation we've got here. I'm very, very worried about the direction and safety of the country.
Well, Jeff Stein, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Stein, who covers the spy agencies and foreign policy for Newsweek in Washington, D.C. His Spy Talk column originated in 2005 at the Congressional Quarterly, where he was Homeland Security Editor, and he moved to the Washington Post in 2010, an Army Intelligence Case Officer in Vietnam. Jeff is also the author of three books, including A Murder in Wartime, about the 1969 prosecution of top Green Beret officers for the execution of a suspected enemy spy. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining what could be the most amazing power play and greatest coup by the Koch brothers, who are poised to rewrite the entire U.S. Constitution.
Listen, do you want to know a secret? Do you promise not to tell? Whoa, whoa, closer. Let me whisper in your ear. Say the words you long to hear. I'm in love with you. Ooh. I've known a secret for the
What's my name? What's my station? Oh, just tell me what I should do. I don't need to be kind to the armies of night that would do such injustice to you. Or bow down and be grateful and say, should take all that you see to the men who move on me in dimly lit halls and determine my future for me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lisa Graves, who is the co-director of Documented, a new investigative website at documentedinvestigations.org. She served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
It's nice to be on, Ian. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you, Lisa. And it's extraordinary that this whole story about how the Koch brothers could completely rewrite the American Constitution completely reshape the entire foundations of the United States, and that they're very close to doing it, because there are two ways to alter the U.S. Constitution: by amendments process, which is complicated and takes a long time, and a much quicker process, if it can be pulled off, is to get two-thirds of the states in this country to ratify a constitutional convention. So two-thirds of the states of the United States are 34, and the Koch brothers now have got 28 states signed on, and they're talking to another six states, most of which are Republican-controlled. So they're almost at the point of pulling off this major coup.
Well, that's right. The traditional way our Constitution has been amended, in fact, the only way it's been amended throughout the history of our Constitution, is through amendments that were brought up before Congress and then ratified by the states. So two-thirds of Congress and then ratified by three-fourths of the states. But what the Kochs and some of these billionaires and millionaires are backing is a constitutional convention. And the last time the United States had a constitutional convention, we were operating under a thing called the Articles of Confederation. And there was a desire to strengthen the central government in that document. And so there was a convention called to basically tweak the Articles of Confederation. And in the act of calling that convention, our founding fathers threw out that entire document, basically started over, and created our U.S. Constitution. And so back then, if you think about it, those founding fathers, many people have called them geniuses. But the single thing that is particularly different from nowadays is not just that they're so much smarter than politicians of this day, but that there weren't really corporations. There were only a couple corporations in existence in the entire world at that time in our history. And now you have a situation in which corporations are dominating American politics, dominating American elections through these dark money groups, like the groups that the Kochs help fund. The idea that these dark money groups would basically create a constitutional convention, would control, in essence, through its terms, who gets to serve at that convention, and they would dramatically have the potential to dramatically alter every aspect of life in America through this convention process, in which basically the leadership in the states, Republican governors, if they're in those positions, the Republican leaders of the Senate or House or Assembly in those states would be the delegates. And so by having the numbers, if they were able to get 34 states, they would likely already have two-thirds voting in favor of whatever it is they want to begin with, because they would be a two-thirds majority of Republican delegates to that convention.
So the point of the convention is that once it's convened, it essentially takes the United States Constitution back to a blank sheet of paper. That is inherent, is it not?
Yes. I mean, some of the proponents, there are three main groups that are pushing this convention. One of them has been around for a long time. ALEC has been part of that effort. The American Legislative Exchange Council has been part of the Balanced Budget Task Force, Amendment Task Force, the BBATF. But two newer groups have come on the scene, and they're funded with a huge amount of money, and one more than the other. The one that is tied to the Kochs or connected to the Kochs is funded to a much greater degree. And those groups, while they pledge in some ways that this would be a narrow convention, that it would only focus on a balanced budget, for example, or a couple things related to that, the fact is that there would be very little way for any of us to limit what they take up and what they push. Of course, it would have to be ratified by three-fourths of the state, so there's some potential break on it. But the fact is that these guys have had their eyes on changing our environmental laws, gutting them, changing our tax laws, which they partially succeeded with Trump just last year in terms of dramatic changes that benefit themselves to the tunes of billions of dollars, changing the rules for people who are injured or killed by corporations. There's a whole slate of things that they would want to accomplish by, in essence, fiat, through a constitutional convention, that they would have politicians who are likely tied to them as the delegates of that convention.
So, along with the Kochs, the other group, I take it, is the Texas-based nonprofit Citizens for Self-Governance. Is that the one you're referring to?
There's a convention of states effort, and then there's a related one that is tied to a Texas millionaire. Both of those groups have been very active in these last couple of years. And in fact, there's a bit of a dispute about whether they can really accumulate these calls for a convention that have been, some of them have been on the books since the 1970s, whether they're sufficiently identical to count up the 34 needed to invoke a constitutional convention. But the problem is that in the meantime, the right wing has successfully taken over a substantial portion of the federal judiciary, including a number of deeply and highly unqualified Trump nominees. And this U.S. Supreme Court has been extremely partisan under the rule of John Roberts. And so I don't think that we can count on our courts necessarily to protect us from a runaway convention, which is what it's called, a runaway constitutional convention.
And what role would the judiciary play in constraining it, if assuming we didn't have the Gorsuch types and Roberts, et cetera? I mean, the restraint, from what I can tell, from what you've told us, Lisa Graves, is that once you have this runaway convention, the Koch brothers rewrite the entire basis of the U.S. Constitution, the laws of the land, et cetera, we're completely screwed. And then that whatever comes out of this runaway convention has to be ratified by, is it 3/4 of the states?
Right. So it's unclear, and quite frankly, this is a situation in which I'm not sure if any of your listeners know this, but just last year, ALEC, which is largely funded by the Koch brothers, has taken up the idea of repealing the direct election of senators. So there's a whole lot of things that they would want to accomplish. They have been after repealing the idea of even having an income tax. That was an amendment to our Constitution more than 100 years ago in the era of the robber baron to try to have some capacity to fund our national government and to do so on an equitable basis, a progressive taxation system that resulted following that amendment. They would, you know, on their list of their wish list, is an array of dramatic things. In fact, if you look at the Koch brothers' core philosophy, the philosophy that Charles Koch really embraced starting in the 1960s, I consider that to be what they called it back then, which was anarcho-capitalism, the idea that the only role of the government is to protect private property, that private property rights are paramount, that that's the role of the military and the police, and that all the other rights or conditions of citizenship should be determined by the so-called free market. And so I have no confidence that these that the Koch brothers or the politicians that have been doing their bidding for the last several years would put American interests first, the interests of the American citizens, the American people, rather than the interests of the Koch brothers and the extreme agenda that they've tried to fuel through funding ALEC and its manifold extremism.
And again, I'm speaking with Lisa Graves, who's the co-director of Documented, a new investigative website at documentedinvestigations.org. She served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. But going back to the time before U.S. senators were elected, as a prior to that, of course, they were appointed by the state legislatures. And of course, that was a huge invitation for corruption. And the railroad barons essentially appointed their flunkies to the U.S.
Yep.
Senate from all of the various states. And that was the way it was. So reversing, turning back the clock on that one is so flagrantly corrupt. I mean, it's just breathtaking. Hard to believe they could ever get away with that. I mean, how stupid are we?
It is.
Go ahead.
When you think about it, this is another form of this sort of extreme partisan gerrymandering that the right wing, that the GOP has been engaged in. You have a situation in which they have, you know, dramatically changed the rules for Americans in terms of being able to vote, making it much harder for American citizens to vote, for the American people to vote, making it harder to register, making it harder to have places to vote. And then they have dramatically changed these in significant ways with the aid of computer technology, cut these districts so that basically they choose who their electors are versus the electors, us, choosing who represents us. And this is a natural extension of that because the one thing that they can't gerrymander is a Senate race because the Senate is voted on by all the people in a state. And if they were able to repeal that direct election of senators, a profoundly anti-democratic, undemocratic, counter-democratic effort on their part, they would be basically saying that the gerrymandered legislatures in the state could choose who among their peers would do the bidding of basically their funders. As you say, it would take us back to these dark days of the robber baron era. And so that's how extreme, how reactionary the agenda is that the Kochs and the corporations, quite frankly, that are funding ALEC, are in fact by pushing these sorts of extreme measures.
Well, already it's pretty clear that Donald Trump is the perfect president for the Koch brothers because he's completely incompetent, totally passive, doesn't know what he's doing, and will sign anything they put in front of him. And if you look at the record, so of all that's been achieved, if you can use that word, in this Trump administration so far, it's all been the Koch brothers' agenda, including the most recent so-called tax reform. So they are laughing all the way to the bank. At what point do the American people find out these new plans that they have for us, they've only just got started. If you think they're taking over America now, wait till they get their constitutional convention.
Well, that's right, Ian. And I'm sorry I spoke over you before. I was just so excited to talk about it because it's just so extraordinary. I think more people need to know about it. But you're right. When you look at the only so-called accomplishments of the Trump administration besides instilling a massive amount of fear among immigrants and women and transgender Americans and school kids and others with their extreme policies of doing the bidding of corporations and trade groups like the National Rifle Association, what you see is the legislative accomplishment, so-called accomplishment, is that tax reform bill, which wasn't reform at all, which was basically a huge giveaway to the Koch brothers and to their children and to the children of these billionaires to be able to take home huge fortunes, limit the tax on corporations and on these estates. And now, as you say, Trump really isn't a detail guy. He's basically letting them call the shots. They have a budget that is a cruel budget. That's the Trump budget that's been announced. And that budget, you know, further advances this longstanding Koch agenda to reduce the federal government, to reduce programs that actually help people in this country, you know, just begin the process of privatization. And moreover, the Kochs are actually pushing this massive infrastructure change. The so-called infrastructure bill that Trump touted at the State of the Union is nothing more than a massive giveaway of our infrastructure, our highways, to have more highways be subject to tolls, to have more control of our water resources and natural resources under corporate control through public-private partnerships, which aren't really that really public, but are very private in terms of the profit. And so you have massive giveaways underway while you have this this deception in which so many of these Trump people, Trump supporters, seem willing to believe anything this man says while he's giving away the store and giving away the future of all of us to advance the Koch agenda, the corporate agenda that the Kochs have spearheaded for decades now.
Well, even if you visit the website of Convention of the States Project, which is one of the organizations in favor of this Constitutional Convention, it says, I support the Convention of States Project, a national effort to call a convention under Article 5 of the of the United States Constitution, restricted to proposing amendments that will impose fiscal restraints on the federal government, limit its powers and jurisdiction, and impose term limits on its officials and members of Congress. And then, of course, you find out that they want to get rid of the 10th Amendment, meaning the direct election of senators, and the so-called balanced budget amendment is also a part of it. So they're not even disguising their real intentions, even though, as I say, this has been a stealth operation that's gone under the radar. Just in closing, why is it that nobody is looking at this? I only just spoke with Nancy McLean, who brought it up. I knew about the Constitutional Convention. It's never been used because it's so damn radical. Now it's happening, and it's not just happening. They've got 28 of the 34 states, and they're talking to a whole bunch of states that are very Republican-controlled that are prepared to vote on it. So they're not far from pulling this off.
No, that's right. In fact, Wisconsin was the so-called 28th state, depending on if you go with the accumulated count, and they adopted this, my home state here in Wisconsin. I think for a long time they've been farther away from accomplishing it, but now that they have this control of a bunch of Koch or ALEC legislators in a number of state houses, a number of GOP governors, they think that they can reach this number. And Common Cause nationally has been doing a tremendous job of trying to push back. They were able to roll back previous convention calls in Maryland, Nevada, and New Mexico so that they were able to reduce that. If Common Cause had not engaged in that activity, they'd be at 31 right now in terms of the 34 threshold that they need to reach if you believe the way that they're doing the count. That is, if I don't want to concede the litigation potential to try to litigate against their accumulating these conventions, but it's very scary, and their agenda is very extreme. If you look at that Convention of the States agenda, the idea that these guys care about a balanced budget after what they just did through that tax bill, which has resulted in estimates, conservative estimates of $1 trillion addition to the deficit. They don't really care about the deficit at all. What they care about is trying to kill the ability of the government to work for us, we the people, which is why their groups call themselves so-called limited government groups. That's really a fancy way of saying limited democracy. So they want to use this one tool in our democracy, under our Constitution, a Constitutional Convention, to basically limit our ability to regulate corporations, to accomplish these core values of America going forward. I think it's a tremendous threat to our future, to our Constitution, and to the American way of life. And I'm so glad you're raising attention to it, Ian. I really appreciate it.
And just in closing, Lisa Graves, at this moment, four states are on the verge of voting for a Constitution Convention, and that is South Carolina, Kentucky, Montana, and Idaho. So four are literally on the verge of voting, and that would bring it up to 32. They'd just be two state legislatures shy of pulling this off. So people, I think, should get active, and certainly get active in South Carolina, Kentucky, Montana, and Idaho. This is an extraordinary story. It's gone under the radar. And I think it's incumbent on all of us to do what we can to draw attention to the ultimate Koch brothers takeover of the United States.
That's right. And I would be remiss if I didn't say we know that these groups have been reaching out to gun owners and NRA members to try to push for a convention. So the effort to try to enlist some of the people who have the most extreme views of guns in this country are part of the strategic effort of these convention maneuvers. And so it's extremely worrisome and dangerous, the path that they're trying to chart out.
Well, Lisa Graves, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, who is the co-director of Documented, a new investigative website at documentedinvestigations.org. She served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. We can take a brief station break. We're back looking into the alarming fact that the Koch brothers already have 28 of the 34 states needed to convene a constitutional convention to rewrite the U.S. Constitution. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Alex Koch, who is an investigative journalist focusing on money and politics, who was until recently part of the Political Capital Investigative Unit at the International Business Times, now a freelance writer based in Brooklyn. He has an article at the Center for Media and Democracy, Koch's Bankroll Move to Rewrite the Constitution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alex Koch.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And it seems that the article that you wrote about the Kochs bankrolling this move to rewrite the Constitution is perhaps one of the most important stories out there, and I'm absolutely mystified by why it is not getting a lot of coverage, because there are only two ways to change the United States Constitution: by constitutional amendments, which are laborious and take a long time and quite often don't succeed. But there's another route, which is if you get two-thirds of the states to ratify convening a constitutional convention, then essentially what happens is the entire United States Constitution itself becomes a blank sheet of paper. And those that convene the Constitution Convention already have a jump start on rewriting the very foundations of the American, a new constitution and the laws of the land.
Yeah, that's right. You know, there's a couple of proposals out there, but I think either one could result in this kind of convention that turns into a runaway convention where literally anything's on the table.
And so why do you think it's not getting the attention, since it's, at least to my mind and a lot of our listeners, this is one of the most alarming things that they've ever heard?
Yeah, I mean, when I wrote the piece, there was some buzz about it. I think I was maybe the first or one of the first to connect all the Koch funding for these initiatives that are going around. They've also been happening for a long time, but this is, I think, the most number of states that have ever simultaneously, you know, called for this kind of convention. So we're about six states away from reaching that 34 number, which is the number of states that have to call for a convention in order for one to happen. But I think part of the reason is because it's a fairly esoteric issue. I mean, it's something that has actually never happened since the Constitution itself was written in 1787. There's no precedent for this, and a lot of people don't really know quite what to expect. And it is so esoteric that I think maybe some journalists just sort of stay away from it. And also because there's a lot of this dark money funding behind it. I mean, it's not something necessarily that every state lawmaker, every governor is talking about. But behind the scenes, there are these groups that are funded in part by the billionaire Koch brothers who are trying to make this happen.
Well, but they're not that far, as you point out. You need 34 states to mm-hmm. issue the call for a constitutional convention. They're at 28, I believe. February the 24th, Wyoming became the 29th, and apparently the issue is before the legislatures in Arizona, Kentucky, Minnesota, Montana, South Carolina, Virginia, and Wisconsin. So if you're that close, and a lot of those states that I've just read off, the Republicans control both houses of the legislatures, they're very close to pulling this off, aren't they, the Koch brothers?
Yeah, they are quite close. So since I wrote this article in March of last year, New Mexico actually withdrew its call for a convention. They had done it quite a while ago. But then, as you say, Wyoming added. So we're still at 28. And I'm looking at the website now of the Balanced Budget Amendment Task Force. So that's the group that is pushing for a convention of the states, but allegedly only to pass a balanced budget amendment, not to do other reforms to the Constitution. And so their targeted states include, you know, everywhere from Washington State to South Carolina to Maine. There's eight targeted states, some of which have Republican-led legislatures, which are more likely to go for this than Democrat-led legislatures. So some of these states, of the remaining states, are actually fairly likely to do this. It's just a matter of time, I think. One thing I should make clear to your listeners is that there are these two main proposals for a convention. One is the one I just described, the Balanced Budget Amendment Task Force. The other one is called, they're calling themselves the Convention of the States, and that is actually a much more open proposal for a convention, which could more easily lead to this runaway type of convention. That one only has about 12 states that have signed on, as opposed to 28. So it has less likelihood of happening. But something that, and maybe we'll get into this in a little bit, something that I've heard from a lot of experts about either proposal is that there's just no precedent for this happening. There are not very clear standards or rules for how it happens. So theoretically, these state representatives, we don't even know how they're going to choose the state representatives to go to the convention. But once they're there, they could change the rules quickly or add new rules, and it could turn into this runaway type scenario.
So are the Koch brothers behind both efforts to call for a constitutional convention?
Yeah, they are. As far as I've found, looking through the financing of both, they're certainly major players, if not the main players. In terms of the Balanced Budget Task Force, two of its partner organizations that they list on their website are the American Legislative Exchange Council, also known as ALEC, which is sort of this corporate bill mill where state lawmakers meet behind closed doors with business representatives, and together they author model bills that they can then take back to their states and introduce in the legislatures, which is heavily funded by the Kochs and Koch Industries. As a partner organization is the Heartland Institute, also partially Koch funded, and they're behind both proposals, in fact, for the convention. So those are that's one side of it. The other is the Convention of the States group. And they're probably even more heavily Koch-funded. Some of their biggest funders, giving them millions over several years, Donors Trust, which is sort of a dark money vehicle for big conservative donors like the Kochs. There's a foundation, the Houston Community Foundation, that is funded in part by the Kochs Knowledge and Progress Fund. And then there's this Vanguard Charitable Endowment Program, which is funded by another sort of dark money vehicle called Donors Capital Fund, to which the Kochs give money. So that is to say that if you follow the money, I mean, it certainly leads back to Charles and David Koch.
And again, it would seem, though, the Koch initiative through the balanced budget amendment, if they're at 28 and they only need 34 states, they're likely to get there first. And even if they say that it's all about calling a constitutional convention in order to have a balanced budget amendment become the law of the land, once you open up the constitutional convention, you do essentially start from scratch, don't you? And that means that whatever your motives are stated, you have the opportunity to do a lot more. So presumably the entire Koch brothers' wish list could be on the agenda.
I do think that that's a distinct possibility, and there's certainly the issue of lobbying those representatives once they're in the convention. You know, the Koch network is so powerful throughout the state and federal political system that, I mean, they'll easily have access to a lot of these people. Probably a lot of the representatives from the states will owe their careers to the Kochs, if not more, you know, having received contributions to their campaigns from the Koch Industries PAC or being helped by outside spending groups in their elections by Koch-funded outside groups. So I think I would say this, even if it's a balanced budget convention, it's ripe for corruption. And, you know, as I think generally is the case in this country right now, the more money, the more likelihood that you're going to win. So I think the money's, you know, in the Koch's corner right now, and they could easily influence the process.
Well, aren't they already influencing the Trump administration? In fact, they seem to be behind the scenes getting their entire agenda enacted on. And you could make the case that many in the public and in the press, myself included, are continually distracted by Donald Trump's antics, headline-grabbing, bizarre behavior, which distracts us from the steady erosion of American democracy and the drift towards plutocracy at the behest of the Koch brothers and other plutocrats.
Right, I think that's a very, very important point. You know, we have Trump and what he's doing, but right below him you have all these cabinet secretaries. I would say, namely, Scott Pruitt at the EPA and Betsy DeVos at the Department of Education, both of whom are Koch allies, especially DeVos, and both of whom are really doing their best, as far as I can tell, dismantle the power of those organizations that they're leading. I mean, Scott Pruitt has been quoted as saying he wanted to do away with the EPA, I believe. And he has sued the EPA 14 times when he was attorney general in Oklahoma. So these are people who are slashing regulations, who are trying to privatize schools. These are things that the Kochs have always supported and put a lot of money into. But I should say that, you know, these are incremental changes. A lot of them are fairly large. However, I mean, I don't think there's anything more sweeping than changing the Constitution by bypassing the Congress. So we have a Congress here that is pretty gridlocked and has, I think, only passed, you know, one piece of major legislation last year, albeit a very a piece of legislation, the tax cuts, that is very favored by the Koch brothers. They're extremely happy about the tax cuts. But, you know, largely it's hard to pass bills in the House and the Senate. So if you can bypass them by going to the state lawmakers, who are generally a lot more, even more polarized than the federal lawmakers, that might be an easier way of getting these huge sweeping changes done at the constitutional level.
Well, my understanding is that they want to go back to before the 10th Amendment and have the Kochs want to be able to stop the direct election of state senators to the U.S. Senate from states. Mm-hmm. Prior to the amendment, the state legislatures appointed senators And this was during, particularly during the last Gilded Age, these senators were largely in the pocket of the railway monopolies, etc. And the Senate was incredibly corrupt. And by having direct elections from the whole state having to vote, you get around the successful gerrymandering that the Republicans have done. Because that's why U.S. senators aren't quite as rabid as the Tea Party House members are, who've got really safe seats.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I was just reading about that the other day. So that would effectively gerrymander the U.S. Senate, which was intended to obviously not be gerrymandered, because you have two statewide elections for two senators in every state. So yeah, by going down to the state level, to these state lawmakers, and I must say, these elections for the state House and Senate, they cost a lot less than federal elections. They're a lot easier to sway. If these are a big influx of big money, a couple million from the one Koch group or something, could really sway a state level election like that. Now, these are the people who will be, obviously choosing these delegates probably, but also, would be appointing the U.S. senators under that proposal, which is pretty scary.
Well, just in closing, what can be done then to get more publicity to expose this? I mean, it's not really a stealth operation on the part of the Kochs. It's out there in the open. It's just amazing that nobody's paying attention to it. And it should be pretty clear to everybody that the Koch brothers have a very definite political agenda. They put their money where their mouth is, and they've been extremely active in politics. And now that since the Supreme Court has equated money with speech, they probably have the most speech in America, and they're doing it
right
on a fraction, on a dime, compared to the kind of wealth that they have. I mean, if they're worth $100 billion, the kind of money they spend on politics is chump change.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm not sure how to do that, but I mean, certainly, I think one thing is to emphasize how radical this is. It's never happened before, and also even if it's just the balanced budget, that would be a radical thing. I mean, the Republicans just passed a budget that is nowhere near being balanced right now, and these are people who are allegedly fiscal conservatives. So, we're talking about some real drastic changes, even at sort of the less radical version of these two proposed conventions. So maybe emphasizing just in really analyzing what that would do to the states and to the people who live here would be probably very important for readers to know about this. And national stories are good, but this is happening at the state level. These decisions are state to state. So I'm not sure how much state coverage in some of these target states perhaps is going on. There might be some. Certainly, there should be more, and so I hope that the local and state journalists are looking at this, especially when a bill comes up, they're on that and making their readers as aware as possible.
Right, but Sinclair Media, which is now the biggest presence in television in all of these states and across the country, I'm sure they're not covering it. If they are, it would be very, very pro-Trump and pro-Koch brothers coverage. So there is quite a task ahead. I thank you for joining us, Alex Koch.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Alex Koch, who's an investigative journalist focusing on money in politics, who was until recently part of the Political Capital Investigative Unit at the International Business Times, now a freelance writer based in Brooklyn. He has an article at the Center for Media and Democracy, Koch's Bankroll Move to Rewrite the Constitution. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.